And we need power for a lot of the apps and the computer models and a lot of the data storage and analyses that we use to put all of this information together. And so that is, I know it was a little bit of a stretch, but that's my cloud computing connection. If any of you were wondering about that. But kind of talking about some of that data analyses and crunching that big data that we finally have. I mean, we're very lucky in Minnesota. I am very excited that I get to introduce Andrew Streitz to the stage because I've been waiting to hear this presentation for a long time. And so I hope you are all as excited as I am because it's great. Thank you.
You know, she doesn't know about it, but she's excited and says it's going to be great. So, pressure's on. I am a hydrologist with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I'm presenting the results of a contract my agency had with the U.S. Geological Survey, the local office. Eric Smith was the principal investigator on the project, and he's in the audience today. The project just wrapped up this winter, and the results are available online. I'll describe the data set and show how we're using it in our daily work. The project was supported with legacy amendment funds. Now, when Lanya first set up this conference, I was surprised to hear, as any, that the title included sustainability, pickles, beer, and cloud computing. And I have to tell you, I felt some pressure to try to fit into that unusual group. And then I thought of a connection, so bear with me here. Last fall, at the Freshwater Society meeting, I ran into Dr. Strock, and we talked for, I don't know, 25 minutes about bikes, of course. And we talked specifically about fat tire bikes, of which he had two, and he recommended them highly. And I said, "Well, Otto, I have three bikes. I don't think I could justify a fourth." And he looked at me and he said, "Andrew, there is a formula that describes how many bikes you need." And it's not the typical Otto formula. It's very simple. It's X plus one. You've already figured it out. Okay. I had three bikes. I deserved a fourth. And that comes from the Villa Minotti website. So, armed with that wonderful wisdom, I went home to Duluth and I found a friend who needed to upgrade to a better fat tire bike. He sold me his old bike. And it was a great winter to have it. I'll show you a picture of it here. There it is. It's a Pugsley. It's one of the first production models. It's about 6 years old. And note, it's scary. Now, I've now brought together Otto, me, and the wrong Twin Cities company named Surly. And Lanya's kind of giving me the look, so I think I'll move on from there. I knew I should have run my talk through Mark beforehand. Today I'll be describing the research project that the USGS conducted under contract to the MPCA. I'll illustrate the role of recharge to the subject of sustainability. I'll show how the SWB, the soil-water balance results, compare to water table hydrographs. I'll demonstrate some of the uses of which I put this new data set to work and for the work of my agency. And I'll show you how the gridded data set and the report can become yours. Now, before going any further, let me define what we mean by recharge. For our project, it's infiltration through the unsaturated zone below the root zone. And I'll be using the word potential recharge, the concept of potential recharge, because the infiltrating water may or may not reach the water table because of unsaturated zone processes, or it might be diverted. In any case, in the state like Minnesota, where the water table is often very close to the surface, that distinction is not probably necessary. But nonetheless, you'll hear me use the word potential a lot. Now, our project goals and objectives was to build a statewide soil water balance model. The model is based upon the modified Thornthwaite-Mather soil water balance approach. Second, base it upon meteorologic data from 1996 to 2010. This period was chosen because it had all the most recent and relevant data sets when the project started. Third, include changing land use. The model calculates spatial and temporal variations in groundwater recharge with components of the SWB calculated on a daily basis. And fourth, develop a statewide 1 kilometer grid of potential recharge. Others have walked this path before. Here's a short list. Kanovetsky and Palin back in the 80s. It was never released officially, but many of us knew of it. Wolak on the national scale. And then the piece that most of us are acquainted with, Dave Lorenz and Jeff Deline in 2007 created a product that many of us use. There's also a regional scale implementation of the soil water balance model already in use in Minnesota. The Metropolitan Council is using the SWB model to generate recharge estimates for the 11 county Twin Cities metropolitan area, and that's in service to the Metro Groundwater Model version 3. The work is being done by Bar Engineering. However, the project I'm describing today is notable because it represents the first implementation in Minnesota of a statewide, gridded, calibrated, and updated recharge model. So, how does it work? The SWB model derives potential recharge, here portrayed as an individual cell, where rain, snowmelt, and inflow into the cell are added, while interception, evapotranspiration, outflow from the cell, and change in soil moisture are subtracted. The goal is the calculation of an estimated potential recharge. And there's a lot more detail in Eric's report. Note, too, the USGS logo on this slide and a few other slides. They were prepared by Eric. Here are some of the data sets and tables involved. There's land cover, hydrologic soil groups, and available soil water capacity. We have gridded climate data that includes daily precipitation and minimum and maximum temperature values, air temperature values, and soil moisture retention tables brought all together in the model to produce potential recharge estimates. Now, models are typically calibrated to improve the quality of the simulation. And here you see the calculated, a slide showing watersheds that were selected. For the calculated recharge, we evaluated using the goodness of fit against the base flow component to stream flow in these watersheds. Base flow is determined from three different hydrograph separation techniques, and this method is a first for calibration of an SWB model. The calibration watersheds were chosen according to several criteria. They had to have at least 10 years of flow data for the period in question, 1996 to 2010. They were selected to provide spatial distribution. And the watersheds as a whole are representative of the range of conditions found across the state. And as you might expect, there are assumptions that we made in this process. All recharge becomes base flow to each watershed. All groundwater exchange between superficial and deep aquifers is considered steady state. And the watershed boundaries coincide with groundwater watersheds. The results of the calibration are very good. Here we see three different hydrograph separation techniques on the x-axis, SWB potential recharge on the y. And again, more detail available in the report. So here's the final result, showing the average potential recharge for the years 1996 to 2010. Dark red represents low potential recharge, yellows and greens high values. Some of the results are expected. In the southwest and the western part of the state, potential recharge is quite low. In the karst region, Anoka Sand Plain, we see much higher values, and the North Shore. Now, that's not typically thought of as a high recharge area, but if you think about the process here, the North Shore is dominated by a very thin, unconsolidated overburden, which means the potential recharge can be very high, but the storage, there's just no place to store the water that's infiltrated. The mean estimate is the recommended data set, though annual values are also available. And as you might expect, the annual values exhibit greater variability. I'll show you a use for those annual values in a few minutes. Now here's an interesting graphic portraying the histogram of average potential recharge, inches per year of recharge on the horizontal axis, and the percent of the total number of grid cells per interval on the vertical axis. The most common single recharge rate, the mode, for the over 200,000 1-kilometer cells across the state is 4 inches per year. That makes up about 22% of all the cells. Looking at it another way, approximately 85% of all recharge falls within the 3 to 8 inches per year of recharge. Okay, I've described our recharge model and the inputs that we use to build it. So let me take a minute to address the connection with sustainability, which I think is now perhaps pretty clear. If we use the definition provided in today's conference bulletin, it's obvious that unless we know the amount of recharge to our system, we'll struggle to determine how to protect those resources. And because Minnesota depends on groundwater for 75% of drinking water and over 90% for irrigation, this is a critical issue for us. Now, my own view of sustainability was developed over 25 years ago when my wife and I bought our first house and we had to set up our first budget. I liked listening to a show on the radio, Minnesota Public Radio, called Sound Money. And there was a woman who appeared often, Erica Whitlinger. And Erica had a very snazzy bit of advice. It was very short. It was spend less than you make. And the first time I heard that, I laughed and said, yeah, very helpful. And then I started thinking of it in terms of my own budget. And I realized, unless you think about it, you can fall prey to other assumptions. And I listened to the show, and many people who called in, even though they had more complicated problems, it often came down to that. They might have started with a lot of resources, but they still could run afoul of this if they didn't watch their budget. Well, you can see where I'm going with this. Erica's advice can also apply to groundwater. Use less than is recharged. And although we can't look at a paycheck stub to determine how much water comes into the system, we now have this model for an estimate. Okay, I'd like to take a few minutes to compare the model results against a data set that you'd probably expect to be responsive to changes in recharge, the water table elevation. Further, I'd like to pull apart some of the input climatic data sets to the SWB model to see how they relate to the Obwell hydrographs as well. And I have a specific area in mind to check the results where the system is homogeneous enough to provide a good comparison. This is a plate from Part B of the Stearns County Geologic Atlas by the DNR Eco and Water Services Group. This map portrays aquifer potential yield, with the dark blue representing areas where wells could yield over 2,000 gallons per minute. The area with the most extensive high yield resources is in the southeast. This is one area where I study groundwater-surface water interaction. Here's a close-up with Pearl Lake, my study area, marked with a red star. And here, I've marked the outlines of the aquifer that I'm studying. I've chosen this location for today's talk because the aquifer exhibits characteristics that make for a good environment to find connections between the SWB model inputs and water table heads. I'll talk a little more about my interest in the area in a few minutes, but for now I just want to mention that this lake is surrounded by dozens of nearby high-capacity irrigation pumping systems. Within 4 miles of the center of the lake, there you can find an increasing trend over the last 20 years in the number of wells put in and the amount of water being pumped, and those trends are statistically significant. Okay, a more precise outline of the aquifer, and I've added the location of 4 water table DNR observation wells that fall within its boundary, and they're green circles. All are shallow wells completed at approximately 25 feet. I'll be comparing the annual recharge estimates to the hydrographs for these wells. I'll refer to these different wells by their compass direction from the lake. Here's the first observation well hydrograph showing change in head from 1994 to 2010, with feet above mean sea level on the vertical axis. All of the wells I'll be showing you here exhibit similar patterns of head trends for the interval covered by the SWB model. The first well is a few miles northwest of Pearl, and I marked the year 2000 with a blue arrow to identify the distinctive decline in head that starts in 94 and starts recovery soon after 2000. The next is from a few miles east of the lake, again with large decline centered somewhat on 2000. And finally, from a few miles south. Same feature with the arrow to mark the year 2000. I'm interested in this declining head feature because it's a major event in the local hydrology and an obvious place to look for a link for a climatic signal. I'll now show you how we can generate local recharge datasets to compare against these hydrographs. Here's a close-up of Pearl Lake marked with the stippled pattern for Pearl, and I've overlaid it with an SWB grid of estimated potential recharge for my study area. There are a few grid cells that lack a recharge value, such as Pearl Lake, and because they're dominated by surface water and therefore lack a near-surface unsaturated zone, no recharge value is calculated. The lighter the color of the cell, the higher the potential recharge. Values range from 1.7 to 9.8 inches a year of potential recharge for this domain. I've clipped the recharge results from the statewide grid in ArcMap. I can repeat this exercise for each of the years of 1996 to 2010. Once that's done, we can compare the change in recharge against the change in water table head. And that's what we have here. I've selected one of the Obwell hydrographs in red with elevation on the left-hand axis. The average annual estimates of potential recharge taken from the SWB grid are displayed as blue diamonds on the right-hand axis in inches per year. The recharge estimates match the head values very well. In years where the recharge increases, the head rises, and they also fall in tandem. I've included the blue arrow again. Now, I've averaged the recharge value between the stated year and the value from the year before. This both smooths the data and takes advantage of the delay in response of the Obwell head to the climatic data sets of precipitation and temperature. To state it differently, the calculated recharge is not immediately expressed in the Obwell head, though in this sandy superficial aquifer it may in the following year. Now that we know that the recharge model does a good job of estimating the change in aquifer heads, I want to pull out some of the climatic inputs to see how they compare and hopefully illustrate how SWB builds on the input files. First, though, let's rule out one possible explanation for the drop in heads in the late 1990s. This is a display of the total irrigation pumping for the mediate area, showing that irrigation volumes increased steadily from 1990 to 2007, during the time the head hydrographs first fall and then recover. The blue arrow, again, shows the base of that well hydrograph trough. It's not clear from looking at this how the pumping might be causing this feature. If the cause of the drop is an increased pumping, maybe it's a change in precipitation. Here's my demonstration hydrograph in red, and the total annual precipitation is determined by the NOAA National Climatic Data Center for Central Minnesota in blue. Precipitation in inches on the right-hand axis, blue arrow as before. I've averaged the precipitation data using a 3-year lag, and the result is an interesting match with the hydrograph. It doesn't fit as well as the complete SWB estimate, but you can see the correspondence. So what about temperature? This display shows the representative Obwell hydrograph, to which I've added the average annual maximum temperature data, also from NOAA. The average maximum temperature in central Minnesota is in blue on the right-hand axis, which is inverted because I assume that higher maximum temperatures will correlate with higher evapotranspiration and increased pumping for irrigation, both of which could be expected to lower the water table. Note the rise in the average maximum temperature tracks the changing groundwater elevation in the years leading to the groundwater trough, marked by the blue arrow. I'm now using a 3-year lagged average using the previous year's data. And here's an alternate temperature profile based on average maximum temperatures for July and August, the months of greatest evapotranspiration and irrigation. Temperature again in blue, inverted, and on the right-hand axis. I'm using the same 3-year lagged average scheme. This temperature profile tracks the observation well hydrograph pretty well, especially through the decline in heads through the year 2000. Now, Eric, it's not that I didn't trust you or the model, but I always feel more confident using such tools when I'm able to confirm the relations between the data sets. Okay, let's finish up with a demonstration of the use of the SWB results on some of my projects. I've been building a model in the groundwater, building a groundwater model in the Pearl Lake area, which, as you now know, is dominated by surficial sands. I'm interested in the area because of the growing irrigation pressure on the resource. Pearl Lake is part of the DNR Sentinel Lakes program, which has been extensively studied by the DNR and its partners, providing me with lots of critical information. Again, I've overlaid a map of the site with the SWB results on 1 meter grids. And here's the histogram of grid cell values for the model area. This varies from the statewide results I showed you earlier. The mode has now increased from 4 to 7 inches in the vicinity of Pearl Lake. Here's a second example from the Cass Lake Superfund site in northern Minnesota, from a model submitted by a consultant on behalf of the responsible party. Now, I often don't have a lot of time to devote to model review requests from our remediation division, but I can check to see if the model makes use of the standard hydrogeologic data sets in common use by the Minnesota modeling community. Have they used county geologic atlases from the MGS and the DNR? Have they used calibration data sets from the DNR Observation Well Network? Have they used stream gauge data from the DNR MPCA Cooperative Gauging Site or the USGS gauging site? And now I'll ask, have you used the USGS SWB model for recharge? I first received the draft SWB results last winter, just before receiving this Cass Lake model run. The recharge used for this model was reported to be less than 2 inches per year, which I thought was too low. Before the SWB model, I'd only be able to say, based on my experience and a hunch, I don't like this. You can imagine how that's received by the consulting community. A hunch is a difficult thing to quantify, but with this data set in hand, I was able to recommend a higher value. And to be clear, I don't require that a consultant follow the SWB model slavishly, but they have to have a justification for why they're not using it. And if you're curious, the potential recharge ranges here from less than 1 inch to 8 inches a year, with an average potential recharge estimate for the domain of 5.5 inches. A final example. The agency groundwater team develops comprehensive groundwater reviews of watersheds for surface water staff performing watershed and TMDL investigations, total maximum daily load. This is a shot of the agency watershed webpage, and I've rested my cursor on the Grand Marais Creek watershed, which is not to be confused with the Grand Marais on the Lake Superior. Clicking on it leads you to an individual watershed page with reports, data, pictures, etc. Let's start with the watershed outlines. The watershed lies in Marshall and Polk counties, with the town of East Grand Forks visible in the southwest. Here's the clipped recharge data set for the watershed, and you can see that the colors are darker than we've seen before, indicating a low potential recharge. The range in the watershed is from 0.7 inches to 6.5 inches per year, with the highest values upland and the lowest found along the Red River. This is the histogram of the potential recharge data for the Grand Marais Creek watershed, where the recharge estimate is shifted to the left considerably from what we've seen in Pearl Lake or for the state as a whole. The average recharge is only 2.2 inches per year. Average potential recharge. Eric drilled me on that. The groundwater unit has added this information to our watershed groundwater reports, and we also combine analysis of stream flow, groundwater levels, and water quality information. We feel that the potential groundwater recharge is an important new factor in understanding the dynamics of water quality and quantity, and has important consequences for the use of groundwater supplies and the vulnerability of surface water. Okay, one last results slide. 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was talking to Evan Christensen about this project, and he asked if the model had anything to say about our changing climate. Did we see anything in the data to show that the recharge has changed with time? I mentioned this to Eric, and in response, he ran the model again for two new intervals, shown here, 1980 to 96 and 97 to 2013. This display shows the difference between the potential recharge calculated for these two periods. Therefore, in the display, Blue shows areas where recharge is increased from the earlier period, and orange where it's decreased from the earlier period. These two time periods are all the data we have in Minnesota to perform this type of calculation. Now, once again referring to climatic input files, to provide a check, I used NOAA's National Data Climate Center data again to run trends on precipitation and maximum temperatures for the period 1980 to 2013, so combined. Focusing on the north, I found increasing trends in precipitation from North Dakota to Lake Superior. Over the same period, I found higher maximum temperatures in the north central and northeast, no matching increase in the northwest, which goes a long ways towards explaining the rising recharge in the west and decreasing recharge in the east. I think this kind of analysis has quite a future. Now, if you wish to get these for yourself, you can do a search. We have the state of Minnesota has changed how it displays, how it distributes GIS data sets and other such data sets. I think people were used to going to the DNR Data Deli and to the MPCA page. But now the new method is the Minnesota Geospatial Commons. So you do a search on that, add groundwater and recharge to your search, and you'll find this. The data and the project metadata are available here, plus a link to the report on the USGS site. Alternately, you can start at the USGS site for the report and then get a link back to the Geospatial Commons site. In conclusion, I've shown you the connection between groundwater recharge and the concept of sustainability. I've described the survey's work on recharge under contract to the MPCA. I've demonstrated some of the uses to which I put this new data set in the work of my agency, and I've shown you how you can get the report and the data for yourself. Thank you.
Yeah, I see some hands going up already, so are you ready for some questions?
Only if I can choose who can't ask questions.
Yeah?
Nobody in the front. Kelton.
Question about your map showing the watersheds that you used to calibrate the model.
The 35?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looked like there was a lot of contiguous watersheds along the north and west side, south part of the state, but there was kind of a large swath in the north central and south central that didn't have any. I just wondered if there was a reason for that.
Well, remember we said that watersheds had to have gauged information for at least 10 years in this period, and some of those areas that you're pointing to are areas where it's very difficult along the northern tier. I'm not sure if all of them fall into that category, but I mean that was one of the filters that we used. Eric, anything to add on that point? Okay. And are those reasons discussed in the report?
Yes.
Okay. Great. He said that some of them, some of the watersheds were filtered out because of their size or because of some disturbances, and those reasons are covered in the report.
Bob Tammon, Sudan, Minnesota, iron mining country, and I saw your map there. You showed higher recharge rates along the North Shore. And there appears to be a streak there inland that looks like it's pretty close to the Mesabi Iron Range. Is that what I'm seeing there? A little lighter streak. And I guess my question would be, is that what that is, that we have a higher recharge rate in that mining area? And what is it? Are we getting recharge with degraded water from our pits and tailings ponds, or what's giving us that little streak there in the St. Louis County?
The Giants Ridge area. I think you need to remember that just as the North Shore was kind of an unusual response, it's not what people would have expected, high recharge there. You can't jump to the conclusion that there's high recharge because of specific mining activity. I think that if you were interested in an area like that, that it would be better to look at the grids. Remember when I showed you individual local areas and the grids were clearly marked? Here the grids are lost due to the coloring, but you'd have to go to that and look at how the grids actually laid out for the area of interest. So we aren't dependent upon a map like this. We can actually look at the data on a local scale. And then I think it's more appropriate to ask those questions.
Brian Davis from the Metropolitan Council. I think it'd be really interesting if a year from now, if you could come back and instead of showing us a map of past versus present and the difference in potential recharge like you just did there, which I thought was really cool, instead take the present data, that most recent 10 or 15 years, whatever it was, and then take the same data set, leave everything the same, but take for every day, take the temperature, increase it by 8 degrees Fahrenheit, run the model, and then show us what that is. Maybe you could do that a year from now. That'd be very interesting.
Okay, first I'm going to weasel my way out of coming back a year from now. Second, I actually had a conversation with both Eric and Evan today. Evan is very interested in this kind of information. He's provided Eric with some of the international committee that's looking at climate change and has provided some of the model runs. And Eric has talked about running the model again with these projected temperature and precipitation changes so that we don't have to wait a year. Eric can show up sooner than that. And you could run it for any period that you're interested in. Now, the scale changes. We wouldn't be able to do 1 kilometer centers. I think you said, yeah, it's a much coarser model. But yes, that's possible, and it is based on the other model results. And you could look at that and see what that bodes for Minnesota. Editor.
Question over here. Andrew. Andrew.
Okay, so Andrew there, and then carry on for that.
Rich.
As I understand it, the model is calibrated by river discharges, largely, correct?
Calibrated to river discharges,
okay.
Yes.
So is it assumed then that everything that you're coming in with your base flow, in other words, your base flow estimate, is then directly attributable to the recharge?
You know, I neglected to say something very important about that, that there are assumptions that we made.
Right.
And first off, that all recharge went to base flow.
Okay.
And second, that surface water watershed boundaries coincide with groundwater.
No, you said those things.
Did I say those? Well, then why are you asking this question?
Because I want to make sure I understand.
Okay, fair enough.
Then the next question is that if there's something wrong with the assumption, for instance, that all recharge goes to the rivers, okay, then let's say something else has changed within the watershed, within the hydrology, that has caused an increase of, let's say, loss of storage, for instance. That then would look like increased recharge, right? So if you had, for instance, a large number of tile drains that were being installed in a certain watershed that were causing water to then, you know, go basically from storage into the surface water, it would appear to be a higher recharge.
And so that would just not be in the model development, but that would be in the calibration.
Right.
And it would be one of those points. Yeah, right. It could be a different lag. But the model is built and then it's calibrated. If something like that is happening in the watersheds, some of these points might move, is what you're saying, right?
Well, if I understand the graphs correctly, but I'm not sure I do.
These are simulated base flow measurements. And they would shift, but it's in the calibration. And you're right that, I mean, we know that that's happening right now. So, I mean, there's all sort of, watersheds are not the natural systems anymore.
Right, but when you showed the map that showed the difference in recharge for those two periods, the very strong differences that exist, and then if you think about those maps with respect to where one would normally expect to see quite a bit of tile drainage.
Yes.
It kind of looks like that might be an alternative explanation.
And tile drainage has increased dramatically from 1980 to 2010. In fact, when you talk right. to people in the counties, they say every year is a gangbuster year, and then the next year eclipses it.
Right.
So it's hard to know. In different parts of the state, like the red has had dramatic increase in tiling in the last, to go with the ditching, right?
Right.
So
you know, the assumption kind of may potentially lead to that confusion.
Mm-hmm. And this is broad brush.
Yeah, no, I get
your point is a good one. You need to keep those in mind.
Okay.
Thanks. And sorry for roughing you up there.
And I don't have to ask my question. Mine was along the same lines as Rich's.
Oh, okay. That's an easy one.